everyone, and welcome to another edition of Kyle and Patrick's Yet To Be Named podcast. It's been a little while, so we have a lot of topics to cover. Where do you want to start, Kyle?
Well, let's start with you trying to replace me.
Well, I didn't...
I saw that. I heard that. You said it on the podcast. I heard you say it.
I don't think that I said I wanted to replace you. I think I said that...
You said you have replaced me. You didn't say you wanted to. You said you already did.
I think that... Well, since... I mean, Lena was... If she's doing a podcast with me, I felt like that... Isn't that replacing you?
I mean, it's a guest spot, man.
Well, yeah.
It's a guest spot.
But the guest spot is to replace you.
Well, for the week.
Sure. Right, that's... I think that's what I meant.
I mean, it's like, you know, on a TV show, like, you have a famous actor or actress, and they're a special guest star. Like, you can give them that tag all you want.
Right.
We can make this a three-person... Right, like pod and have that person be a special guest star. That's cool, but you know.
But when you have a replacement, when you have a guest host to like a TV show, they're replacing the host
sure.
for the week.
No, but you say guest host though. That was not
okay.
what you said. You said replacement. I'm just. It's semantics. It doesn't matter. No one's
okay.
upset.
I meant guest host.
We got a lot
I
of topics.
I meant guest host.
I don't want to bicker too much on
okay.
this. So it's September. It's really cold out up here in the Shire. I'm sure it's cold where you are as well. And we wanted to talk a little fall ball with you guys. You want to kick it off?
Yeah, I guess we can say I stopped by Notre Dame. Just randomly happened to be driving through South Bend last Friday. And the Notre Dame coaches and staff were nice enough to let me come stop by practice. And... I had a couple of thoughts of things. I'm going to save a lot of my Notre Dame preview stuff. I'm going to head back in a couple of weeks to go cover one of their later fall scrimmages, and I will do a more extensive preview there. But one thing that I feel like is a cliche that often gets told to kids both at lower levels, but I think especially around recruiting tournaments of things is a sort of not lacrosse skill related things that coaches are watching for and that help is it's not just what you do, but how you react to it that they're looking for. And that was one of, I've watched a couple Notre Dame practices, and one of the only times that Coach Corgan has ever stopped practice was for exactly that, that he was not happy about somebody who took a bad shot and missed a good opportunity. He did not like their reaction to it. So, one observation is to confirm that cliche that gets told to kids is entirely true, that, you know, Division I coaches, it's something to pay attention to is if you're trying to play your best and look good for coaches recruiting you, I guess Division I or otherwise, they are definitely watching both their players and others to see how you react to a situation when you make a mistake.
Yeah, I think all coaches are looking at that. Just in general, like, it's not just going to be people that are trying to get recruited for college listening to podcasts like this. Hopefully it's like kids that are trying to go out for their high school team or something. Like, you know, reacting poorly to something is the easiest way to get in the doghouse. And I definitely support that notion 100%.
And especially matters for a team like Notre Dame, where they're trying to play transition, trying to ride hard, that's, you know... The more important that is to your coach, the more important reacting, getting right back in there to go get the ball again becomes important on a play where you do make a mistake and turn the ball over.
Absolutely.
My other big thought is I actually didn't, I did not, they have all new numbers and I was not prepared enough to get a roster ahead of time to see who all the freshmen were to find some new numbers. But one guy who stood out that went enough to go figure out who he was attackman Brian Willits, who was a top 10 overall recruit for Inside Lacrosse's our rankings, the number 5 attackman from Smithtown East. And I thought he looked really good. He made a couple of plays that impressed me enough for me to go find out who he was. I knew he was a freshman since I hadn't seen him before. And he's a big kid. And I think that... that lends itself to kind of being a nice complementary pairing to Ryder Garnsey and Mikey Wynn at attack for Notre Dame, either this year or next year, since all those guys will be back again. again next year, and I think you will definitely see him, or I guess I shouldn't say definitely, I would not be surprised to see him on the field in some capacity for Notre Dame this spring. That they're a team that plays, that will play a fourth and even fifth attackman. So whether he ends up as the third starter or not, I would guess you'll see him on the field for the Irish in the spring.
Sounds great. I know you went on another trip, but I'm going to jump in here. I've been on my second iteration of kind of like a showcase of lesser known schools. Last year I called it the D3 life and went to three colleges that I have personal relationships with. This year I decided to flip that a little bit and do the D2 life, because where I live, there actually are a decent amount of D2 teams. I visited two of the three that I'm going to visit this year. And Friday I went to Merrimack, which is probably the best known team out of all three teams that I'm going to pay a campus visit to. And, you know, I don't want to spoil too much, because like, I really enjoy writing the articles. And I think that the most fun thing about doing in-depth visits like this is figuring out what makes these programs unique and what makes them tick. And like, the best adjective I can use to describe Merrimack is probably just like, they're just like mad, you know? And I don't mean that in like a, oh, they have problems, they're so angry kind of way. I mean that in the best possible sense, you know? Like, for example, everyone in the NFL is like expecting Tom Brady to come back and just be angry and go beast mode on everybody just because he's, you know, serving the suspension and all that. I think that's how Merrimack shows up every day. And part of that is most of their coaching staff, with the exception of one UMass player, our former UMass player, went to Merrimack and played at Merrimack and loves Merrimack, like loves it. And that in a way that's like so voracious that it's, you know, they're those kids that like, they're going to be 40 and still have their practice shirt from when they were freshmen and wear it to the gym. You know what I mean? Like that's the kind of guys that are running the show there. Mike Morgan, head coach, Brian Brazil, assistant coach. I mean, there's kind of like a Massachusetts, New Jersey combo swagger to Merrimack that is very unique. And I mean, it's funny because like if you go there, you're like, how is this place like fielding a great top 10 team every year? And I found that answer. And it's a very intriguing development to sit down, and they were very gracious with their hospitality. Like, you know, I'm going to have to redact some special words, but I think
of your words or their words,
they were very honest and they were very open. And, you know, the program is fascinating how it grew and where it is now. I think it's going to be a very compelling story. The next place I visited, I just got back from
when you say sort of that, do you mean like a chip on their shoulder when you say, talk about playing angry?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it a little bit of maybe like a Brown State type vibe?
No, because Brown State is very like, Brown State has some anger behind it, but it's also like peaceful.
That's true.
Even though Lars isn't there, there's still some peace around, peace and love in Beartown. But yeah, no, there's no peace and there's no love, man. These guys warmed up doing full field passes and turning them into like weave sprints without the coaches prompting at all. And they were going 100% like from the jump. Like they stretched, they did all that stuff. But as soon as it was time to take the field, I mean, they're like itching to get on the field. The women's field hockey team was playing or finishing up a practice before them. And the kids are like pacing by the gate like animals. it was great. I mean, you know, it's what you want to see, especially if you're a coach. That's what you want your kids to kind of act like, yeah, I need to be here. I want to be here. I'm so excited to be here. And that was kind of the vibe that I got from them. And that's, it's very interesting to have that be someone else's team and like see that and be so close to it. Cause usually in our, you know, capacity as reporters, or however you want to phrase that, what we do, people that cover games, we don't get to see that intimate of a look usually at a practice. It's usually kind of toned down a little bit. There was no toning this down. And about 10 minutes into the practice, it started downpouring and they just went harder. It was awesome. I had a really good experience. The second place I went is Franklin Pierce College. I actually coached there in 2005. So it was, and it was my second job ever. It was very tough. And it's seems like a lot of progress has been made. When I was there, we were struggling to get 20 kids to like be eligible and play and, you know, on the field. And, they had 40 kids at practice this morning at 6:15. They were very drilled. Every kid knew where to go. There was a lot of chirping and hooting and hollering, but it was all positive or like in jest for the most part between both the kids and the coaches. Seemed like a very relaxed atmosphere until it seemed like somebody was a little slack in what they were doing. And then it was just like a cannon went off and like coaches and players were just on a kid if he didn't kind of fulfill his duty in a drill to the best of his effort, not his ability, but his effort. And that was few and far between. I think it happened like three times where like kid got yelled at for not, you know, running hard enough or chasing hard enough after a ball or shooting to the right spot. So I was really impressed with what I knew of that place before and what it is now, under coach, Rick Senator, who actually coached at the third school I'm going to go to later, in October, St. Anselm College, which has its own, story as well. Another place that I coached with tying into your visit, the great and storied, Jerry Bird, who is now at Notre Dame. So, the D2 life is very interesting, man. I think D2 teams in general and players and coaches feel really slighted. They feel like they don't get enough coverage from anybody, IL, any other media entity, you know, their own school, even, you know, they really have that kind of like complex about them where they really want to prove it to you. And, it was cool to see two different sides of that spectrum. Guys that are on the come up, guys that are trying to win a championship, kind of juxtaposed with each other. It's a very interesting experience. I'm really, really looking forward to writing the articles and the, you know, the kids are actually really well-spoken and very open as well, which you don't really get at the D1 level where you've been coached by SIDs and, you know, have media savvy training, as little as it may be in lacrosse. It's not like,
yeah, I mean, that basketball, totally depends football on the players. School.
Yeah. It really depends on the school and like their major, like if they're comm majors. That kid came up to me, at Pierce this morning and asked me, if we were giving out internships. And I said, you know, I would love an intern. You should call Terry Foy. So hopefully he does that. So hopefully guy that asked me, please call, Terry Foy. His contact info is readily available. But it sounds like you had a little bit more fun than I did, 'cause I got up at like 4:30 this morning and you went to an event of the summer.
Yeah. I just wanted, but my one concluding thought about Notre Dame that I thought of while you were saying this is that it is amazing to be in South Bend the Friday before a football game and tell people that you're not there for the football game.
Yeah, they probably look at you like you're crazy.
Yeah, right? Like they didn't believe me. That people, I'd be like, yeah, I'm here for like to watch the lacrosse team practice. I'm leaving. I'm not staying for tomorrow. And people would be like their minds just didn't know how to comprehend it, which I thought was funny.
Yeah, that's definitely that big school mentality, man. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, yeah. Even Jerry Byrne a little bit when we were talking about coming back, he didn't quite understand that I was cared more about the lacrosse scrimmage than what football game was going to be going on that weekend.
Yeah, we're weird people, man. I mean, when lacrosse is your number one sport, people kind of look at you funny unless they're the same way.
Yeah, oh, so. Absolutely. But yeah, I did. This was earlier that week, so it's coming on. Was it 2 weeks ago now? But I stopped by. I made a trip up to Canada to go watch games 4 and 5 of the Man Cup, which was my first big, I guess, my first big time box lacrosse experience. I don't know. Have you ever been to an NLL game?
An NLL game? Yeah.
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 I have not. They're all, nearest one, they're like 6 hour drive for me, and I just have never found the right opportunity to go catch one. But this was my first senior A games on that I have ever been to in box. And it was a lot of fun. Got to go hang out on the res for a little bit. Games were at the Iroquois Lacrosse Arena in Six Nations, Ontario. Got to see Randy Stotts, Dylan Ward, a bunch of guys I was familiar with. So that was a neat opportunity to get to go see them up close and personal.
Nice. And I saw your selfie with Dylan Ward.
Yeah, that is true. Dylan was kind enough after the game to go grab the man cup and for a picture. And one of the pictures that he took, I let me come take a selfie with him, which was kind of interesting because I had inadvertently gotten a haircut that weekend just before the trip that made my hair length just about match him, and I had been growing out a beard that just about matched his as well. And somebody actually asked if we were brothers.
Did you go with a regular ticket or did you go with a press pass?
No, I went with a regular ticket.
And they just let you on the floor?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's like 1,000 people there.
That's awesome.
And so after the game was over, they like a couple guys went and got their children. Like Jeremy Thompson has a daughter who looked about 2 or 3. A couple guys went and, you know, grabbed, like Dan Dawson went and grabbed one of his kids. They let on, but then after they had sort of finished the awards and just everything, they just opened up the gate and everybody, I mean, it was at that point was almost exclusively players' families, went to go out there so that everybody, you know, you could go get your picture taken with your mom in the man cup. And so I kind of went out there as well, but I mean, the arena only seats, I don't know, 1500 people, 2000 people. So it's kind of,
I've played there.
Yeah. It's kind of a small time, like it's relatively speaking. You know, compared in the grand scheme of sporting events, you know, not there, it's not that big of a deal. I actually went the afternoon before game five. I actually went over in the afternoon, and was chatting with Steven Stamp a little bit, who was there, who's doing play by play for the game, and went out on the field and shot around a little bit because nobody was there yet.
That sounds like a great experience. I feel like more people should go check that out.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a fun time. I mean, I think the biggest thing, especially being in an arena that small, where I mean, there's only, you know, 10, 12 rows of seats that all in box where the seats go right up to the boards. That every seat in the building is just fantastic. And I think that's one of the things too that helps make the NLL to a certain extent a better in-person product than the MLL. All other things being equal, in terms of the lacrosse. That you can get so much closer to the action and you're right there. If you want to go sit right up against the glass, you can. You're, you know, inches away from the players.
Yeah. No, I remember getting my face smashed into the glass and seeing lots of people. So, like, literally inches away from you. So, it's definitely an intimate venue for sure. And that sounds like an awesome experience.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't.
Unfortunately, we have to.
Oh. I just wanted to say to another guy. Got to talk a little bit with Doug Jamison, who is likely going to be a first-round NLL draft pick tonight.
We're going to get to that.
So shout out to him.
We're going
to
get to that.
But
yes, fair enough. Unfortunately, we have to kind of talk about sad news in the lacrosse community. Tim Thomas, who ran Lax Dirt, a lacrosse blogging writing site that covered indoor and MLL. Passed away last week, really kind of very suddenly. I hadn't talked to him this year, but I had talked to him for as long as he's been running Laxter. Laxter had ceased at the end of last or the beginning of this season, I believe. They weren't producing any more content, but they produced a couple writers that write for, you know, other publications. Tim himself was a pretty prolific writer. And you know, probably best known for people that listen to MLL radio. He did several shows on MLL radio, in his time working with Major League Lacrosse. He was from, you know, Concord, Mass. He's a Mass guy. He's a New England guy. I wasn't, you know, friends with him. We never really hung out or anything, but I mean, he's one of those guys that made lacrosse his life and put a lot of work into his coverage of the MLL. You know, basically started a site from nothing and, you know, got a lot of readers. He was a good writer. I think I wish he wrote more, if I'm honest with you, if I'm selfish talking about it. I wish he wrote more. I thought he was a pretty good writer. He was an excellent writer about MLL. He and I actually agreed on a lot of stuff. I went on his show a couple times, but wasn't a consistent presence there. I mean, stuff like this happened. I mean, he was 36. Stuff like this happens, and you kind of just, you know, I didn't know what to do. I talked with, you know, other people at Inside Lacrosse, like, what do we do about this? Like, how can we help? What can we do? And, you know, the best conclusion was, you know, hopefully we can talk about it openly on a forum like the podcast. And, you know, I that's what I'm trying to do right now. I think I was the only one that really had contact with him and the IL staff. And, you know, I just wanted to let everybody know that he has a memorial fund on GoFundMe.com. So you can go to GoFundMe.com and search for Tim Thomas Memorial Fund. His wife had gastroparesis, and he wrote a book to kind of help the fundraising to combat that condition. And if you make donations in his name in lieu of like sending flowers or anything like that, I think that's the best thing you can do for it. We'll put a link for that site and the exact page you can go donate to. But you know, it's tough, man. It's real tough. And I you know, he was someone that cared. There are very few people I think that match or go at the MLL with the veracity that the people that write about it go at it with. And I don't just mean me or Rosie or even you. I mean kind of anybody that covers the MLL, because it isn't easy to do it. You really have to care. You really have to put your heart into it and your head into it and really just go as hard as you can. You know, it was a marathon for him covering the sport for all of us. And he's really going to be missed. I know he wasn't really producing anything, you know, towards the end, but it doesn't matter. He made his impact. He has several shows on MLL Radio Archive. You can go check him out if you've never heard him before. MLL Radio, you can just search that and listen to stuff he's done. Very, very opinionated, you know. And I'm happy that he and I kind of were on good terms. And you know, this is like tough to talk about. Like it's like awful to talk about something like this happening.
Yeah, absolutely. In the community. He's not somebody that I knew at all. But I mean, anytime. I guess I shouldn't say knew it all. I only knew him, you know, kind of through his written work. I never was able to meet him or really interact with him. But I mean, anybody passing away at 36 is way too soon, especially, you know, somebody who's married and you think about what his family has to go through. Just so you know, I express my condolences to his family and wish them the best in a really tough time.
Absolutely. And again, we'll put a link to donate to that cause in our podcast description here. But in the spirit of that, we'll talk about a little MLL. We're going to talk a little MLL now. And the big question that everyone's asking that I apparently can neither confirm nor deny, but can definitely just stir the pot a little bit. What's going on in Rochester?
I think this is one that you tweeted the answer, except it's not really totally the official answer yet, but most likely will be, which is, I'll let you say it since you're the one who knows these things.
Yeah, Rochester is it with a fair amount of certainty I can say is moving to Dallas. They will play at the Star, which is the Cowboys training facility. And there's a lot of evidence to support this happening. You saw basically every Rochester player that was eligible declare for player movement.
And notably, I think on the other side, Kyle Hartzell declared for player movement, who is...
And he coaches in Texas.
Right. I think is the probably the only MLO player who lives in Texas. The only I can think of off the top of my head.
Maybe the only current one, yeah. You'll see, you know... I don't even know if they'll be the Rattlers anymore. I don't have any of those details, but I mean, you know, the league has been running Rochester as a franchise for years. And by running, I mean, they're basically fronting the cost because Rochester makes nothing at the gate. Okay. They don't have a local deal, as far as I know, with any TV in upstate at all, even though they probably could. I don't know why they wouldn't, but they don't. Probably because they have the league running the operational side, and then they have Pseudo doing everything else with like a couple, you know, assistant coaches to help them out. I think it's really sad. I'm kind of torn up by it, but at the same time, it's like Rochester, like you reap what you sow. Like all the Roch fans that are like hardcore, like whatever, like how did you go from like drawing 4,000 to like less than one? You know, I know you moved across the city twice, but I mean, if you're really hardcore fans, like, you gotta support your team. Like, the gate receipts matter, guys. Like, the gate receipts matter. Trust me. If the gate receipts didn't matter, Boston would still be playing at Gillette. You know what I mean?
But well, in that case, that you're talking about the cost of playing at Gillette had to be much more than the cost of playing at Harvard, didn't it?
It did, and the attendance was much higher at Harvard.
Right.
And there's all sorts of... But the fact remains that the Crafts wanted to be, you know, the family that kind of runs Gillette, they wanted to be in the lacrosse business. You know, they wanted to make that deal work, and they did for one summer, but it ended up being a stopgap because, you know, not enough people would come out for a lacrosse game.
Yeah, and I mean, they're looking at their commitment. They used to. One of the first Division I games that I ever attended was at Gillette. They had a doubleheader a couple years back.
Yep.
I think that was more than a one-time thing. I think they did it a couple years in a row. And they're hosting the Final Four this year.
Yes. And again, to reiterate this point, because I really think it's important, go stay in Providence if you're going to the Final Four. You're welcome. Thank me later. Buy me a soda at some point. All right. So Rochester looking like it's the end. It's one of the original six. You know, it's a team that matters. It's a team that has history. And I'm going to be sad to see it go. I'm going to be really sad if Pseudo doesn't make the trip, which I wouldn't expect him to be honest with you. I should say that the reason I'm talking about this as fairly open as I am without making it an official report is because no one will actually go on record. But I get texts like I've gotten at least a dozen texts from people telling me it's happening, and they're different people and they're at varying levels of the league. And I trust most of them. So it's not a manipulation situation. So I think that it's real. It's happening. Sorry, Houston guys. I don't really know what happened with your franchise, except that your financing was terrible. And that's why the deal fell apart last summer. But you know, Texas is going to get an MLL team. That's it's pretty exciting,
which is cool. Definitely to see expansion into a new area, and especially one where lacrosse has started to grow.
Yeah, I think recently it's a new hotbed. Sure,
I feel like dubbing things new hotbed. I don't know if it's a hotbed per se, but it's definitely an area that's seen some growth. One of the hotbeds of growth.
You can say hotbed as long as you say it like someone from Baltimore. Like hotbed.
Okay.
It's a new hotbed.
Okay. No, I just meant I don't like that to compare. I think to compare like California or Florida or, you know, like Georgia or Ohio or like Michigan, I think it's difficult to compare the level of lacrosse that's sort of happening in those areas where the game is growing. That's why I hesitate to call it, you know, a new hotbed.
Well, I'll tell you what it does have, what Texas does have, and that's athletes.
Yes.
So the coaching's maybe not there yet, but it's getting there. And you know, as you said, Hartzell's one of the coaches, so they're at least importing lacrosse talent to the higher end schools. And it's only a matter of time before all those athletes catch up with all that talent and all that ability there. But one more thing that we want to talk about MLL-wise that I told you would happen, did I not? Yeah, I told you this was happening.
It's, I mean, it...
And what did you do?
I tweeted about it.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, that Paul Rabil waited till the last minute to sign his extension with New York.
Yes.
Before the deadline to file for player movement.
Yes. To make the most dramatic signing possible that everyone knew was happening. And even put out little false rumors, by the way. I have my little birdies. My little birdies heard a little false rumor that someone was trying to acquire him before the deadline. And I don't know why. He was, his tag for compensation was 2 first round picks. I don't know of any team that went 8-6 this past summer that would pay two first round picks for Rabil. I don't.
Really?
And that's not a, yes, really, because I don't, and that's not a pejorative on him. It's not to say he's not worth that. I just think that no team was willing to admit that they were that far off and he's the missing piece. Do you see what I'm saying? I feel like everyone that went 8-6 feels like they went 12-2.
Right. No, that's 12-4. But they were a couple goals away from being like, 11-3 or something.
Right. But I'm talking like all those teams have an overinflated sense of accomplishment because they all went 8-6. Like every single one of those teams is like their front office is like, wow, we had a great season. Like we missed on a technicality or whatever. Right. And it's like,
yes.
You know what I mean? Like they're the overinflated sense of self there, I think is very prevalent. And I think that paying that price for Rabil would be counteractive to that mindset that I think they all had. That's not to say that the other two teams wouldn't gladly give up 2 first round picks, because of course they would. Because Atlanta's crazy, and Florida, if they can't make it work with the group they had offensively this past season, like, why not? Let's just throw another guy on there. I feel like they would do it in a second too. So.
Yeah, I guess the big thing though, the reason that I asked you about it though, is I was thinking, in terms of making a media splash, I'm not sure that waiting until 5 o'clock on a Friday was the best way to go.
Well, I think that they were counting on more people paying attention to that being the deadline.
Right, and I think I was almost thinking that potentially, well, and just to be honest, and first of all, I think this is something potentially, it's something I talked about with a couple other people, that it's sort of, this is the MLL's first run through free agency, and I think that the players, and I think the media and the league didn't necessarily quite know how to handle it from a coverage and a PR standpoint. And I think that...
They don't even have a PR director. How are they going to handle it?
Well, right. That's for starters. That's one thing.
R.I.P. Paige Gadsby.
But if you wanted, this decision to have press and have coverage, why would you make it 4:30 on a Friday?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. I just knew that it had to happen at the deadline. It smelled like such a Rabil move, and I knew he would do it, and then he did it, and I was like kind of shocked that he actually did it. It's like, oh, he's definitely going to do this, and then he did, and I was like, wow, all right. So I'm fairly in lockstep with what you're planning here. All right, I see what you're doing.
Right, I guess I just mean, because don't all the other leagues that have trade deadlines or, things like that, don't they usually put them at, 3 o'clock on a Tuesday? Because they're trying to maximize press coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they... CML has any idea how to do that. So
right, well,
it's
their first time going through it, and I think that Rabil probably anticipated more people talking about it that I think sort of... I guess I felt like the MLL and the teams, there was just so much breaking news, this player signs 2-year contract. Coach has positive things to say about, returning player... who was on the team last year and will be on the team again, which, of course the coach is going to say positive things because he was on the team and he's going to be on the team again. If they didn't have positive things to say, they wouldn't have re-signed him.
Everybody signs 1-year contracts anyway every year.
Well, not anymore. They used to.
No, the ability to sign multiple year deals has always been there.
Oh, really?
That's why this whole thing is shady. I mean, it's always been there, but it hasn't been, you know, ratified. It's like it's a tacit agreement as opposed to a concrete one. But, you know, guys that sign deals can still get traded.
Right.
No one's rocking a no trade clause. The closest thing to a no trade clause is having two first round picks be your compensatory payment, which is what Rabel has.
Well, they could always sign a trade. He could sign with New York and then they could trade him for less than that if they wanted.
Yes, that's kind of what I'm saying. Right. Yeah. That's why it's like not even real free agency, because you're not giving that much. I mean, what were there only like two players that signed with a different team? It was like Jeff Reynolds and Terry Kiminer both went to the Blaze.
Yes.
Which, by the way, are both three smart moves.
Jeff Reynolds might have been the third. There's only one, though, that actually cost the team a draft pick so far, I believe.
Right.
Wasn't it Reynolds cost them like a fifth round pick?
Yes. And Kiminer didn't cost anything because he wasn't rostered at the end of the season by Charlotte. So he wasn't on the list as a compensatory or anything. And I actually have the list. I don't know if it's like 100% fair, but it's not, you know, terrible. I think some of the players that are marked as like first round pick compensation are a little high, but you know, it's supposedly a combination list made with the players' advisory committee and the league office.
Yeah, so. That's one of the issues I think I have with it is just that if a guy has too much value put onto him, it's really he doesn't have the option to move. And if a guy the value is too low, then it just creates a steal for a team that gets him,
right?
Which I think is to a certain extent somewhat problematic. But I guess I mean there's no perfect solution because the old system was problematic in its own ways, where you had, you know, with players sort of forcing trades to get to where they wanted to go. So there's no perfect solution. But
I think, no, I mean, it's not a perfect system either. It's like you said, it's the first go round and it's been rocky. Let's be real. It's been rocky and it's kind of had a weird coverage cycle. I mean, we have two posts about it on Inside the Cross because it's the off season. Like they were literally announcing the signing of players the day after the championship.
Yeah, like, which I thought that was kind of weird. There should definitely be at least a 1 week or two week moratorium on sort of any transactions after the championship, so that you don't have any other news.
Yeah, it was like, well, we're gonna steal whatever we can sail in the eddy of whatever's left over by, you know, the championship games.
Maybe, I guess.
Whatever. It didn't make any sense to me, but you know, it's something that, you know, we at least, you know, covered a little bit, and we have a full comprehensive list put up on the site right now. And I did a roundup about a week and a half ago as well of the players that had signed to that point, and have team by team breakdowns. A lot of teams didn't do anything, so that's kind of telling.
Oh yeah, and there's some players too that haven't, that were eligible like for player movement but didn't necessarily re-sign either.
Yeah, and also the thing is, like, teams can talk to their team if they declare for player movement. They can go back to their team.
Right.
It's not like they're not eligible to sign with their team. They're not getting DNR'd, you know. They're not getting, like, kicked out of the hen house. It's just,
which is, I think, you know, that's why so many Rochester guys opted in.
Right.
Well, it was just because in the event, or the likely event that Rochester does move, it created the option if they don't want to go, if they don't like the new ownership, or they don't want to go to Dallas or wherever the team might end up.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree. But let's transition from MLL. NLL.
Another
point.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think that it's always also sort of an interesting this cycle with sort of Rochester and going on. It's the first sort of off season for LSN. That it's sort of interesting because they're kind of owned and run by the league functionally. And it's sort of the first time they've had to deal with not that much going on in the lacrosse world to sort of talk about and cover. And it's been a ton of MLL coverage is sort of what we've gotten out of them.
Right. Well, that's what they have access to.
Right.
They don't really have access. What other stuff do they have access to?
I mean, but I think that's, at this point, I mean, they have it's anything that you, I mean, they have money. You could bid for things. You could hire people to put out your own recruiting rankings. It's fall ball started. There's college practices going on. It's the same things we talk about.
Yeah. But those things aren't across the street, and those things didn't fund you.
Right, I know. I think that's that aspect, I feel like more than up to any point until now, it sort of has revealed itself. In the coverage, for example, of the Rochester situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, they can't comment on rumors that are, you know, not in the best interest of their entity. Right.
So, right. Well, I mean, they've commented on them, but the commentary is sort of like, well, 3 weeks ago, John Galloway told us that he wasn't going to play for anybody but Rochester. So the fact that he has opted into player movement means that Rochester's probably not going to exist, because otherwise that's not what he told us. And it's sort of
It's funny you use that example. I was on that show.
Yeah.
So I was co-hosting that show, and he did say he was a Rattler for life. But if you're a Rattler for life and then the Rattlers cease, you don't have to be a Rattler for life. And I think the thing you can draw from that that's more important is that everyone thought he was like, oh, well, he's clearly going to go play for Florida.
Right. Well, I think I think that's more what he's addressing. But anyways, just the point that, like, so you're putting, like, that's a stretch from that, you know, no one's ever changed their mind before about where they want to go. Like, yeah. Just to use that to mean so John Galloway knows that Rochester's moving, but why don't you ask John Galloway? So then why don't you ask him if the team's moving? You know, right. It's sort of
counterproductive.
Well, just you're, I don't know, your intention, like, so you're alluding to the fact that John Galloway knows what's going on with Rochester, but then you can't go ask him to figure out what exactly it is.
Well, yeah, if the ink's not dry on the paper, man, it's not happening yet, which is why no one will go on record with me.
Well, right, except that's not...
I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's right. They want... So the thing is, too, that the MLO wants to control this as much as they can, and like they do with all of their big announcements, you know, they can't. I mean, the way you control media is with public relations, and they don't have a PR director right now. So how are they going to control how they react with media when they don't really have anyone in the position to do that?
Well, I mean,
it's a catch-22. What are you looking for? You know, their best interests are always going to be at the forefront, for better or worse. You know, and I mean this, I'm saying LSN's best interest is the MLL. And that's always going to be at the forefront. And if you think otherwise, like, you're a fool. Like, I'm sorry. Like, that's where the bread is buttered. That's where you're getting the majority of your output. So they're going to do what the MLL wants. And the MLL doesn't want them to announce that Rochester's leaving yet.
Right, right. I think it just sort of is an interesting, and that's why, you know, before I think people are talking that, you know, LSN should get the rights to the NLL. And I think that's sort of why that sort of thing is not going to happen, because why would the NLL want to give their streaming rights to the MLL, to the MLL, or to an entity owned by the MLL?
Yeah, they wouldn't.
Right, exactly.
Because they're in competition.
Right, I guess that's just more my point. It kind of, this MLL offseason, I think, has sort of shed some light on sort of where LSN stands kind of in the lacrosse streaming and media landscape.
Yeah, they're an MLL-centric streaming network.
Right.
Yeah, they have more in common with the NFL Network than they do with ESPN.
Right. Right.
And I don't think that's unfair. I don't think they would think that's unfair. I don't think that's unfair for me to say. And
no,
it's
I
not
don't.
A shot. It's not a criticism even.
I don't think so. Right? I don't think so either. I think it's maybe my point was more, this is, I think, sort of the first time that we're really seeing that in action.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mean, like, you can see the seams on the ball. Yeah.
Right, right.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
That before, other than, I mean, they streamed MLL games, but other than that, there really wasn't necessarily any difference, so to speak. There just sort of wasn't a test of sort of that
kind of... Test of bias.
Right, Right. Yeah. Just because there's so much going on with Division One happening and the NLL season going on and MLL coming up and women, you know, women's NCAA season and UWLX. There's just sort of so much going on that there wasn't the same. And the MLL didn't have any issues like the team moving to Rochester that the LSN coverage would be influenced on.
Right. Except for the All-Star game being a disaster, but it's fine.
Right. That's a fair point. But
yeah, so, you know, I'm sure there will be an announcement soon either way, or the MLL will ride it out all the way to the draft and make the announcement at the draft, even though everyone knows before that. But again, just trying to move on here. We're going to wrap up with some indoor talk. And we got to start with
the
obviously
hats.
You're going to listen. Yeah, man. These hats are fire. I love these hats. These draft hats are sick. New Era hats. Shop.NewEraCap.com. I don't care if they're not paying us. These hats are awesome. They're awesome.
I think so too.
Print. Woo! Cement print with the letter logo and the kind of pictorial image logo inside the letter. All of them with that cement front and bill and the team collar back. They look great, man. My only gripe is they're $32 and they're not even fitted. Come on, man. I want a Black Wolves hat.
We looked into it too. It's not 32 Canadian. It's 32 American.
Yeah, we fact checked that. It is 32 American, which is what, like 40 Canadian?
It's somewhere around there, like a little bit more than that probably.
Sure, that's a lot of loonies there, eh?
Yes, it is.
Yes, no doubt about it.
No doubt about it.
Sorry. I almost had it.
We fact check our Canadian impressions on this podcast.
Absolutely.
Hats are amazing.
I haven't seen them on people, and I think you, like me, looked at them and were like, oh, like those are some nice hats. I might need to add one to my personal wardrobe.
Oh, absolutely. Plus, it's like really funny that I'm in like an MLL journalist or writer, and I'd be wearing like an indoor hat. I think that's really funny. just personally, I think it's ironically funny. It's like hipster funny. Right?
Yes, but I mean, a good-looking hat's a good-looking hat.
That's also true. It's also
what
true.
What can you say about it?
Now you just tell people in New Hampshire that it's like a minor league baseball team or something. They just believe me, so.
Why wouldn't you want to tell them that this is a lacrosse team?
Nah, I mean, I don't cover the NLL, so.
I did have somebody, a Canadian, I won't reveal who, but has told me that they wished you covered the NLL.
Yeah, I talked to him. They tried to get me to do it last year, and my response to that is like, why would I want to do? Not that I don't want to do it, but I don't want to step on anyone's toes because I wouldn't change how I do things, you know. And I know they do things very differently in the NLL, and I think that I ruffle enough feathers as it is, so I don't need to go to another league and.
I just figured you had enough to do between gear and the MLL and NCAA that it's right that the. If it was, like, for example, going on right now, that would be different than, I mean, the time that the league happens is sort of right in the middle.
It's a sweet spot for gear, for sure, yeah. It's a very sweet spot for gear.
Right, but it's NCAA preview time coming up at, like, the heart of the season, and then by the time the playoffs happen, it's the MLL has started that you're sort of...
Yeah, it would be tough to do it, although I did write a feature on the Black Wolves last year, which was a lot of fun. I went down to Mohegan... Or no, yeah, Mohegan, right? They play at Mohegan.
They play at a casino.
They don't play at Foxwoods. They play at Mohegan.
I'm not sure which casino it is in Connecticut that they play at.
Yeah, Uncasville. It's a really interesting setup there. It's pretty cool to watch a game inside of a casino. It was tough to find my way in there, but you know, I was on assignment, so I couldn't really have any other luxuries of the casino. To take advantage of, but it was great. And NLL games are so different from any other lacrosse game because it's a lot more like arena football, ice hockey.
It's hockey. Like, to me, that's like everything about like the way the indoor game works. It's just like it's all of the sort of subjective things are done like hockey.
Yeah, it's the easiest comparison in terms of mainstream sports for sure. Yeah, it's very like if you were what's the analog for outdoor soccer?
It's somewhere. It's I mean, not but it's, football. It's but it's sort of it's more soccer and football esque. Like it's four quarters. Like there's a halftime. Like you know, with indoor game, I guess the NHL does quarters, don't they? But they'll do like the senior A does three periods with two intermissions, just like hockey.
Right.
You know, there's an actual penalty box. The penalties are 2 minutes, just like hockey.
They're played at hockey rinks most of the time. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Everything, they call them power plays instead of like man up.
Yeah, sure.
Just like hockey.
There's a lot of differences.
Or it's forechecking, just like hockey. Like there's so many hockey words that they use. It's sort of everything that could be more hockey-like is more hockey-like about indoor. But anyways, the one sort of... Neither of us are really NHL guys, and in terms of evaluating prospects, we're not the people to talk to. But the one sort of question I did have for you is there's two NCAA sort of field-only Americans who are on Steven Stamp's top 50 NHL prospects. And those are Miles Jones and Brandon Mullins. And by the time you listen to this, the draft probably will have happened, so we'll sort of... We'll know where they went and, you know, what teams they ended up with. But do you have any thoughts on the prospects for the two of those guys, having watched a bunch of both of them in the field?
I think the one thing that jumps out and that would translate is the physicality. And I know, like, athleticism is a catch-all term. I don't really like to use athleticism as a way to describe a player because I feel like it's lazy. But the physicality that both of them play with, I think, is more important than the athleticism because I think, you know, and this is going to sound bad. We talked about this before the podcast. I said I wasn't going to say this, but I'm going to say it. Athleticism is less important in box than it is in field. Because and it's a different kind of athleticism.
That's what I think. Right? It's not so much. I wouldn't say it's a different kind, and it's something I tweeted about with regards to the NHL Combine that I can't imagine that 40 times are relevant at all for the NHL.
Yeah, I think
the field's just so small.
They're just it's relevant to have a measurable to be like, okay, well, our transition guy went down. We need another fast guy that can play both sides and spell us while we're subbing. You know, that's like
kind of...
Do they
even need to be fast, that fast? Like, are they really, like...
I think, yeah, I mean...
The field, like, I mean, from a restraining line to restraining line is, what, like, 20 yards? The field's only, like, 60-some yards long.
Right, and I mean...
Is the difference between, like, 2 seconds versus 1.8 seconds... In that like 20-yard dash,
the fastest game on 2 feet, man. And the ball—I mean, the ball always moves faster than people.
That's what I mean. The ball moves.
Saying about these. So going back to your original question, these two players are intriguing because physicality and physical presence are in box, in my opinion, more important than speed. Like exactly what you're saying,
right?
And these are two players that exemplify, you know, not just American hustle style, but again, physicality, ability to absorb checks, run, you know, not necessarily run through them. You don't run through a ton of checks in box, but give out a hit, take a hit, and, you know, hold on to the ball.
Nobody's running through them, checks or otherwise.
Right.
And if anybody is going to run through somebody, it's probably going to be the two of them.
Right, and that's where I think their value is. I think that there is a huge difference in box defense compared to field defense, even if you're doing short stick here, talking about Mullins. But, you know, if you can adjust to the, I guess, less checking, more positional tendency of a lot of box defense and a lot of off-ball help, on the weak side, and holding your position, having that be more important and actually sledding kind of downfield instead of up a lot of the time, like hockey, you will see, a difference. And there's a big learning curve, man. Like it's not easy, to do, but you aggressiveness really helps you acclimate. So I think, you know, these two guys are both big, strong and aggressive. And I think that puts them, that's why they're in the top 50. You know, that's why they're there. I don't know. I mean, the other thing too is like, how many other field guys make an NFL impact? And the only guys I could think of are big guys like this, right? So, or guys that are strong and have like a
strong. Top of my head, Brian McGill, Joel White, Joe Walters.
Yeah. Well, Joe Walters is a skill player.
Right. I mean, did he play box growing up at all? I want to say an upstate guy, isn't he?
Yeah, he didn't play until after college, and he wasn't good at first. He's done interviews where, like he said, like, yeah, I wasn't good, and I almost got cut, and I had to work, and I had to figure out the game. It's unless you've played it growing up, box is very hard to adjust your style to, especially if you're like Walters was an outside shooter. Right. So in college, he wasn't the creative kind of lefty, elusive Dodger that he was now. He was a grip and rip shooter. And that's what he was good at. That's what he pulled up from anywhere. He didn't care. He had no conscience. And, you know, to his credit, he's really evolved his game. And box has really helped him do that in field as well. So you really have to have that kind of mentality of go for the layup instead of the jump shot at all times. That's kind of, you know, maybe that's not what all box philosophy is, but that's kind of how I've always been taught it and what I've observed.
Oh, yeah, because if you shooting outside from box is a recipe for the goalie to save everything.
Yeah, unless you're wide open and you caught the ball off a skip.
And you have a screen, the goalie moves like, right, if your goalie's moving across the crease and you have a screen where you can't see it.
Exactly. And your placement is that good, and you're that good of a placer right. of the ball. So yeah, I think, you know, we were looking at the list and Blaze Reardon on here, and you were like, oh no, he's like actually really good. And I was like, what?
The backup? Did you not goalie? See him for the U.S. team?
No, I again, I'm not a huge box guy. I played it briefly, and it was the scariest 2 summers of my life.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna say that he's like he's gonna be an NHL superstar, but like he's a legit. I mean, he was. He belonged on the U.S. men's indoor team.
Yeah. I mean, if you got Handel, he probably grew up playing it and, you know, found a spot and found a place where he's comfortable. I think there's a lot to be said for box players that have different roles in field and the same roles. Like you were saying, that Stamp didn't know that Challen Rogers played offense.
Yeah. Yeah. I asked him about it for the Canadians feature that I wrote this past January for the magazine, for Inside Lacrosse, them in the magazine, about Canadian duos that I wrote about. One of them was Challen Rogers and Brody Eastwood, and Challen Rogers is like a defender in box.
Right, right. How about your boy Matt Landis on here, way down. You see that? Yeah, he's on the list. He's at the bottom. He's not near the bottom. He's around 44 on the prospect board.
Oh, my bad. I did not see him. I thought that Jones and Mullins were the only two. I would say he's probably about as interesting as a prospect as Mullins.
He's as physical, but he's more of a cerebral defender too, though. Like he could probably adjust faster, I think.
Yeah, I would say that. But he's also he's sort of gained just a reputation for just being so good in his footwork. But early in his career at Notre Dame, it was people just talked about like what a fantastic athlete he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right that he maybe isn't the sort of the bruiser that Mullins is.
Right.
He's not a guy that got run over. He can body up. He had no problem bodying up on guys. Like, you know, he could have held his own against Lyle Thompson.
Yeah. Everybody remembers that game. That's kind of his seminal moment. He hasn't had the same impact in the pros, but still.
I think I could definitely see him being a guy who would make an impact.
I love me some Dan Lomas. High point. Shout to my boy, Dan Lomas. The big lefty. We love him. I covered a lot of high point games, and Chris Rosenthal at the draft would just play Annie Up over and over. That was his goal song. And we just kept kept asking for people to free Lomas, and eventually the machine drafted him, but he did not not really see the field this year, unfortunately. Team is too deep. But there's some really interesting kind of prospects here, and you know, again, by the time you hear this, kind of what we're talking about will be a little out of date, but I think it's important.
Here's the real question, though. Who do you think is going to look best in their draft cap?
Ooh, who's got first pick? I don't like the Rush hat. No, I'm out.
Okay.
Let's see. No. The Nighthawks hat is nice. I like the Bandits hat, too, but the Bandits hat looks almost exactly like the
Black Wolves. I meant players.
Well, I want Seth Oaks to go to the Black Wolves, just like Stamp has it in his preview. I want to see that. Because I want to be able to, like, you know, maybe I one day I have a Saturday off.
You're ducking my question.
I am ducking your question.
My question is, who's going to look the best in their draft cap?
Seth Oaks.
Okay. Gonna look great. I'm going to go with Chalon Rogers.
Ooh. Oh, does he have the beard or the mustache, though?
I think he's got the beard. Wait, I don't know. I haven't seen a picture of his facial hair recently.
I'm changing my vote if he has a mustache to him. That's a good call. Good shout. If Chalon Rogers has a mustache, he's going to look the best in his draft day cap, for sure. I'm into that. So, again, kind of check out the caps, guys, and listen to the podcast, and we're happy to be back, and there's always stuff to talk about. It's cold. It's September. We're in fall ball, but we're still going to find stuff to talk about and bring to you guys. And, you know, thanks for listening. You can find me on Twitter at @thekyledevitt, @thekyledevitte on Twitter and Instagram.
And I am Patrick McEwen, a.k.a. the Lax Film Room Guy. That is my Twitter and Snapchat handle. You can also find me on Instagram and YouTube at Lacrosse Film Room, all spelled out. Thanks, guys. We will talk to you soon. Bye.